Over the weekend, we saw the arrival of the Halifax International Security Forum. The conference was put on by the Canadian government and the German Marshall Fund of the United States. According to the organizers, the forum was put together to address the top global security challenges facing the transatlantic community. Speakers at the conference included Robert Gates, Secretary of Defense of the United States, Peter MacKay, Canadian Minister of National Defense, John McCain, Republican Senator from the United States, and many other politicians and military personnel from Canada, the United States, and other NATO countries. Anthony Fenton, an independent journalist who is at the conference, explains how the conference is a sign of Canada's new imperialism.
I'm Anthony Fenton, a researcher slash journalist from Pitt Meadows, BC. Been researching Canadian foreign policy generally. Past 3.5 years, I've been working with John Elmer on a book on the transformation of Canadian foreign policy. Looking at since 9/11, part of the process of writing the book has been trying to understand the mechanisms of the undertaking of what it takes to have and operationalize a Canadian foreign policy. So Canadian foreign policy is broken down into several compartments. Like they've tagged a name to it that they've tried to brand various names. The current name that the Conservative government uses, the whole of government approach to Canada's role in the world in global affairs. They've called it the 3D approach. They've had various names to try and brand a sort of a Canadian imprint on the rest of the world. Like in the 90s, it was the human security agenda that was associated with Canada, and you know, and so on and so forth. Before that, the peacekeeping eras and the so forth. And we've been looking at how these guys operate and how they conduct policy, how in the midst of transformation, what have they done to bring about that transformation on a sort of, you know, almost like a local level. Like, so when conferences come to town about Canadian foreign policy, part of the process of Canadian change over the last, you know, 15 or 20 years has been a process of trying to democratize the Canadian foreign policy process, to engage what they call stakeholders across the country, to get a feeling for what direction Canadian foreign policy should make, put it into the input process. And so they have these conferences, these wine, almost like wine and cheese affairs for, you know, the Canadian bureaucracy and the so-called NGO community and the local media or the national media in some cases. And then in July, it was announced the president of a prestigious U.S. Think tank within the nexus of what you call the Imperial Brain Trust. So it's called the German Marshall Foundation. Their origins in the 1970s, early 1970s, I believe, were with like a big endowment from Germany in the honor of the Marshall Plan, the post-World War II Marshall Plan. And so like there's this implicit, what they call transatlantic connection between the U.S. and the European landmass. Canada was somehow excluded. So the message of this conference we learned about, a first ever and unprecedented meeting of high-ranking military minds converging on Halifax come November, they announced in July. What they said at the time, almost explicitly, was that this conference, first ever, biggest type of conference that's ever happened on North American soil, we're doing this to basically say that Canada has graduated. They've evolved. They have stepped it up to a new level in the sense that they are now a credible imperial power of, you know, of a secondary tier in their own right. And they can stand shoulder to shoulder with us. And the way that Peter MacKay described this in his inaugural introduction to the keynote speaker, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, was that this is indicative of a changing of the dialogue.
The discussion had been framed very much, and I say this respectfully to everyone in the room, EU, America. America, EU was the expression I constantly heard in encompassing the discussion broadly. We have to expand that dialogue and expand the parameters beyond geographic descriptions. North America. That is a wonderful change in the dialogue.
And when you unpack that, it was interesting because you think about North American. Well, how has that concept evolved? And like you go back to like the origins of NAFTA and the role of corporate Canada, like the corporate lobby, which is immense and which they admit and are boasting, they're proud to boast about their role in dictating, basically writing policy and getting it implemented. You know, from the tenure of Thomas DeQuino, who is the head of the CEO Council, the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, since the 1970s. He's retiring. He's been replaced by John Manley, who's the former Deputy Prime Minister, and who's going to be the new voice of corporate Canada to Ottawa, right? But they boast about how they've literally written policy. I guess I was linking the corporate power element to the evolution of Canadian foreign policy, this notion that the development of Fortress North America and how that's been linked both to the processes of globalization and Canada's role as a leading sort of vanguard state that has transformed itself to project and pursue a globalist type of globalization agenda on behalf of, you know, transnational capital. So this conference, you know, we are changing the conversation. Canada is a globalized, globally focused, globally expeditionary state that needs to be respected for that. And this is sort of what these 300 representatives of a global military power and intelligentsia and so forth have arrived at and converged here in Halifax this weekend. One of the ways that they were kind of sort of billing the conference was that, well, it's like a World Economic Forum, but for the military, you know, to plan military affairs, to the future of NATO, the, you know, like how's NATO going to survive? Why does NATO still exist, right? I mean, it's NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization. I was surprised not to hear anything so far about like, hey, should we change the name? There were, I think, a total of 26 countries that I counted in the official attendee list. And a lot of hangers-on and so forth, right? But including they're journalists, but they're like, we call them like embedded journalists. The journalists that are allowed into the inner sanctum of the conference itself, which is mostly secret. The funny thing is that of the 265 whatever attendees whose nationality I can confirm is closer to 300, I think, who are attending, 60% were either American or Canadian. I think it was like 40% American, 25% Canadian, and then like 85% of the rest were European countries or new European, new NATO or wannabe NATO countries, like all of the so-called, you know, the different countries that comprise the former Yugoslavia, you know, like Montenegro and Serbia was there and time. So whatever we saw, okay, so I saw to begin with only the open sessions are in we're in a press room basically in the Westin Hotel, a press room that is located like on the opposite side of the Westin Hotel. I got to look inside the actual room where the sessions are taking place. It's a big room with nice comfortable chairs for all of the private invited only guests. The 300 people we're talking about before. As I said before, it was a meeting of the global military minds, the global military elite. And there were 25 hand-selected journalists or so that they invited to attend and be inside. But they could only report on things according to the public rules, according to Chatham House rules, which means you can say somebody said something but can't quote them or however it goes, right? So as such, you can't name the individual who said whatever you're quoting. Sort of like Seymour Hersh does in most of his articles nowadays. Yeah, a senior official told me that. There were journalists inside. There were also journalists in the press room that I was relegated to. And by that, of course, as I said, you know, you get to watch the open sessions only on the TV screens. And then in a couple of instances, I think three now, holy cow, they've had press conferences afterwards. So, okay, so yesterday, Peter MacKay and Robert Gates, U.S. Secretary of Defense, have their inaugural speech They don't do a press conference after. They already did an official one for the media earlier because they had separate meetings before the conference started on bilateral affairs. So that was that. Then the next session, what happened next was they did have a press availability. Instead of McCain and Gates, two U.S. senators came in and did a press conference for 15 minutes. John McCain and another U.S. senator who had actually a name I actually don't... He was like sort of like background music, so he didn't really even get to know. It was like Udall, I think his name was. He didn't say much, but I think he was a Democratic senator to show bipartisanship. But McCain was the face of the U.S. Political system there this weekend, along with Robert Gates, who, of course, was the Secretary of Defense of George W. Bush in the latter year and a half of his presidency, kept on by the Obama administration as a sign of and a show of bipartisanship. McCain was speaking. He came in, we did a press conference, and we did, there was weird because like he came into the room, there were a few cameras on, but not many journalists had anything to ask him or anything. That's the format. So basically, if you want, and the thing is, the attendees, 300 attendees, and there have been maybe I think three or four open sessions now. So later on, I saw a number of U.S. military officials speaking about. There's one panel on transatlanticism, and with the direction of NATO sort of, and the German foreign minister spoke, and a bunch of others. A lot of it is really it's boring to listen to, to be honest, perfectly honest, especially for the people who are speaking. Of course they're very engaged with it and they're experts. That's the thing, is world experts on the subject are brought in, right, to speak on these issues, quote unquote, the experts and the media representatives who are acceptable, who are part of the in crowds, like the most prestigious think tanks, the prestigious universities, like today's today's conference. Your original question was, who did I see today? The main feature event of today was the panel on Afghanistan, because really Afghanistan overarched and had to overarch the whole conference.
Where do you see Afghanistan going in the next 12 to 18 months?
Within a year to 18 months, we can see a reversal of the what General McChrystal has described as a deteriorating situation. We can see some progress in going into areas such as the Fishhook area around Kandahar, where we can perhaps address some of the poppy issues. I think we can see some success in the training of the Afghan army, which will be a long process given the small numbers that they are in today. And so I think we can show our friends and allies some signs of success. It's not going to be easy. Casualties will go up, I'm sorry to say, just as they did in Iraq.
You've spoken of success in the next 12 to 18 months, but unless you were quoted incorrectly, you were quoted in the papers today here in Canada saying you think the war can be won in the next 12 to 18 months. Is that your view?
I think it depends on what your definition, obviously, of won is. There will not be any surrender ceremonies nor parades down Broadway in New York City, but I think we can see a situation such as we have seen in Iraq as a result of the surge, flawed but functioning democracy, perhaps the only one outside of Israel in the Middle East, probably continued violence for years to come in the form of suicide bombings, etc.
At the same time, you've had a constant flow of Canadian embeds who've signed on to the Canadian military's media embedding agreement, and there have been a constant and continual flow of Canadians to Afghanistan with ever-increasing regularity since Canada shifted to the southern part, because Canada's been involved in the war since 2001, but the emphasis of Canada's shift to the south of Afghanistan in 2005, which again you could tie into this whole notion of Canada's ascension to imperial power in its own right, was Canada's commitment, at the time, an open-ended commitment to fighting where in the area of Afghanistan with no so-called caveats where the heart of the insurgency that their intelligence at the time knew was growing at a sort of like a cancer metastasis rate, you know, not to use that analogy in the way that the military uses it, the cancer analogy. I'm saying in terms of like they knew it was growing. They knew that they had to, quote unquote, put a lid on it. And they also knew in 2005, right, remember the insurgency in Iraq. This is a demonstration of the vulnerabilities and weaknesses of the U.S. empire. Its inability to manage two insurgencies at the same time in Iraq and Afghanistan at just that time, and in part inspired by what was going on in Iraq, the insurgency in Afghanistan was increasing, and they needed allies to step up, step to the plate, provide a battalion or two, whatever, to fill the gaps. And that was what Canada did. In fact, Canada committed to that basically in the lead up to the Iraq War. Like, that was the whole thing. Like, they took over the assignment to run Kabul, you know, and Rick Hillier was the guy who ran it back in the 04. And that laid the groundwork in turn for Canada to make its shift to a more, and at the same time, that's the whole, again, undercurrent leading up to this conference here in Halifax. It's a transformation of the Canadian foreign policy apparatus, primarily driven by the transformation of the Canadian forces in a counterinsurgency capable expeditionary force that can operate alongside the U.S. and its other chief top tier secondary imperial powers within NATO.
The conference was met with some opposition. Protesters participated in a march and rally. We spoke with a few of them about why they were there.
It's about, I respect people's spirit and trying to make, you know, make a bit of a stink about it and have a rally and get some info out to people. So I think that's useful. There's been a bunch of posters around town, leaflets circulated. Mala Joya, Afghan member of parliament who is essentially suspended, is going to be here talking eventually. I think that'll be useful, bringing some people out to get some info. I think that's the most useful thing. I don't think this little rally is going to cause NATO to be disrupted. Its main value, I think, is just to give information to people so they can take a look at what NATO is more critically, and, you know, how Canadian forces are involved in essentially trying to further a war police force.
In the name of democracy and peace, good afternoon, everyone. Very nice to meet you all. First of all, I would like to thank SCAR, ISPRIM, HPC, Halifax Dartmouth District Labour Council, and SALSA, who invited me here to this anti-war rally and give me this opportunity to talk on behalf of my people about the ongoing tragedy in my crying country and also about the realities of the so-called war on terror by US and NATO. The US and its allies occupied Afghanistan under the banner of women rights, human rights. They pushed us from the frying pan to the fire because they brought in power the photocopy of the Taliban, these North Alliance fundamentalists. And under the name of war on terror, they occupied my country. But today, they themselves are terrorizing Afghan people and have deep hidden deals with terrorist groups. They installed a puppet government which is full of worse enemies of my people and are involved in war crimes, lootings, and drug dealings. It's an open secret today that it was that all terrorist groups from Al-Qaeda to Taliban in warlords of the North Alliance have been products of the U.S. government. But the fundamentalist fostering policy of the U.S. and allies still continue, and today they are the criminal fundamentalists who have upper hand in the Afghan government, and their tyranny against my people, especially women, continue. The U.S. and allies pour millions of dollars into the pocket of warlords, drug lords, and even Taliban. Hitler, instructing his propaganda, said, if we want to score a victory, we must chiefly make use of lies. Today, the U.S. and NATO exactly follow this instruction of Hitler regarding my country.
More people are gathering. It seems to be a few dozen people. My guess is around 50 or 60 or whatever. So it's not huge or anything like that. It's just a presence. People are just holding signs up. There's a few big banners saying Canada out of NATO and no harbor for war and things like that. It is most of the usual folks. It's not like a bunch of workers mobilized to come out here, not like, you know, such as if the workers in the hotel decided that they didn't want to support the conference for, you know, what it is, and they decided not to work and essentially shut down the hotel. If a bunch of other workers decided that they were going to, you know, follow up with similar actions and show up in a big mass here, I think that would have some power, but that's not what's here. If people want to really break it down and say, well, what is the real, like, you know, problem? The establishment of a larger, like, super military presence in the world, like led by the U.S. with Canadian forces and all kinds of other forces following the flag. At some point, this production of war would have to be challenged. So I think that at some level, the people who are being recruited to become soldiers would have to, there have to be some interventions there, you know, to try to offer critical commentaries to these vulnerable people who are being approached, as well to, like, people who are already in the armed forces, you know, actually somehow being able to have conversations with folks and establishing some critical commentaries there. Not easy, but I think it's important. There's a lot of other workers that are involved. The dock workers are really crucial for, you know, ensuring that stuff is sent out overseas, like resources are sent out overseas to military forces. You know, there's a lot of ways that people can engage in stopping the production of war, but it has to be really methodical and has to be looked at exactly how things are happening and how can they be stopped. Who's doing it, and how can their activities be transformed? That's a long process. NATO only exists because a bunch of soldiers are out there, a bunch of equipment is being produced to make it all possible. And those processes have to be stopped. I find if it's just turned into a moral issue, then what I worry about is this whole idea that it's possible to stop it with moral arguments. And I find this is often connected to somehow getting it into the heads of politicians and people in power that this is just simply wrong and it's got to stop. And it becomes this hierarchical approach where you're trying to appeal to people in power to change things when they just won't do it. It just, like, it's not in their interest to do that. They're benefiting from the way things are. So I feel like those kind of statements, you know, I guess it makes sense. Yeah, no NATO, Canada out of NATO, and things like that. But really, I feel like it's the problem is right now it's associated with these big moral arguments, like trying to appease to people's consciences to simply, like, feel it's wrong, so people will vote differently or something like that. And I think that's just missing the point.
My name is David Bush, and I'm here because I oppose this security conference. I oppose NATO, and I oppose our interventions, like Canada's interventions into foreign countries like Afghanistan, Haiti. And why I oppose that is that it's a foreign intervention in a land that, like, first of all, the liberal argument it doesn't work in Afghanistan. But second of all, it's like there's no right. Afghanistan never attacked Canada, not even by a long shot. Canada's global security does not depend on like Afghanistan invasion, and that we're doing more harm than good and creating ill will in Afghanistan. And it's a complete waste of resources abroad, and that we could use those resources for, you know, social development in Canada. And NATO itself shouldn't exist. I mean, it's a relic from the Cold War. Why does a North Atlantic Treaty Organization exist in a post-Cold War period? Who are they opposing, and what is their mandate? It's absurd. This conference is just a waste of money in Halifax, and these people, some of them are advocate for some of the most egregious war crimes and things like this. Peter McKay, obviously, this just the story that came out, is complicit in war crimes, and basically, for all the terrible things Peter McKay has done, you know, and in his in the roles in Haiti and stuff, in Afghanistan in particular, on this issue of torture, and to knowingly turn over detainees, knowing that they're going to be tortured, even if it's just by someone else, is a war crime. And covering that up is a war crime. It's pretty simple. On the demonstration here, I just arrived, and I think people are still filing in. It's one that was called by the Halifax Peace Coalition and by the groups who make up that coalition, SCA, like Quakers for Peace. I think there's possibly many. There's not too big a crowd, but not too small. I think that this sort of peace coalition is sort of, in the last bunch of years, struggled to draw a crowd. This is a fairly sizable event, and hopefully that we can build up an anti-war movement again in Halifax, not a necessarily peace movement. We need something that is more discernibly has a critique of imperialism and war, not necessarily just about striving for peace, because obviously peace can be used to justify war. What's often portrayed as a humanitarian interventions, like some people advocate interventions in Sudan, the supposed humanitarian intervention into Haiti by helping Haitians, the UN's role in that. Humanitarianism has gone to war to uphold like humanistic ideals, and what what we see there is just an absolute lack of critique. This idea that peace can somehow exist without justice. These things go hand in hand, along with equality. And this is why I think it's time to rebuild an anti-war movement, not a peace movement. It also respects the diversity of tactics, right? Like, it's not saying that people can't be pacifists, but it's just that pacifists shouldn't dominate an argument and dominate the critique. And I think that's why the anti-war movement in Halifax has floundered, because it's consistently relying on pacifist notions only to oppose war. And I think there's more better and valid critiques. It's hard to build solidarity movements in places like Palestine, that's resisting colonialism and so on and so forth. We need to be able to acknowledge that there are struggles that are violent but are just, right? And that people struggle in Palestine, although you may disagree with aspects of it, they have a right to resist. And then this right to resist has to be acknowledged. And the peace movement can't acknowledge that. And in terms of diversity of tactics, it's allowing a broad range of, like, whether it be totally pacifist, direct action, nonviolent, or violent action. And of course, it's challenging the concept of what is violence, right? Is violence words? Is violence property destruction? Is violence acts against humans? By having a pacifist peace movement only, it stifles the debate around these critical issues that's important to situate in a broader anti-imperialist strategy, right? How do we build these movements up, and how do we enact solidarity in a proper fashion? A lot of people I know who have really good anti-imperial, anti-war politics have in recent years been devoting their work in other areas of social justice causes. And that, so it's hard to say that we're going to take back this anti-war movement, because less and less people are becoming involved in it. So no, I don't see today as a first step. What I do see is that the possibility of that first step occurring.
Okay. And lots of security over there, so you're not going to take those guys on.
No one's going to charge the hotel.
It's the black flag. It's just symbolic, I suppose.
It's meant to represent the negation of flags. They tend to be a big factor in getting people stoked on wars.
All right. Well, I just thought I'd check it out. Thanks for taking the time. Just have to look around. Okay.
My name's Brad, and I suspect that the police suspect that I was one of the people who helped cover over the statue of Edward Cornwallis, responsible for ordering the scalping of indigenous Mi'kmaq peoples as part of a statement about the ongoing tradition of Canadian colonialism stretching from Cornwallis through to NATO. He was also very concerned that we were going to try to, quote, take on, end quote, the line of police between us and certain warmongering NATO top pigs in the Westin. But we reassured him that we have no desire to fight people with guns with sticks. We clearly have more tactical sense than that. Someday there won't be a line of cops. I think the big impact this demonstration is going to have is not going to be on the NATO pigs insulated behind their walls and lines of police, but I think it's been a tremendous opportunity organizing with people and talking to people where we can work to carry on more effective types of actions. And I think it's been really effective for finding each other and finding common ground and meeting people. Even I was very satisfied. Some people carried out a pretty decent wheat pasting poster campaign in the lead up to this event. There were two posters. There was your standard family friendly, liberal, anti-war rally poster, and then a second poster showing a NATO general with a pig's head that said "racist NATO war pigs." Suggested that Defense Minister Peter MacKay, soon to be married, is better dead than wed. Called out American Senator John McCain on being an overtly racist bag of dicks. Very confrontational in tone. Described yesterday's rallies as being to meet and greet the bastards, and encouraged people to wear comfortable shoes. That could mean a lot of things. But it was certainly a more, I think, much more honest poster than is typical for anti-war rallies, because it had no pretensions of like wanting to find common ground with people who want to destroy our lives and the lives of most people on the planet, and basically said what I think most people here today want to say, fuck 'em. Well, I think the most effective actions are those that allow people to expand their sort of spheres of autonomy and self-organization, where people, really get to know their neighbors, the people they work with, the people around them better, and branch out and build networks of confident friendships and not just common membership cards, where people know that they can trust each other for any type of action, even actions with a high risk of arrest or facing police violence. And I don't want to necessarily describe those actions because I don't want to put a limit on them. I think people need to, as they form tight, trusting bonds with people, they need to decide what those direct actions that directly work to solve problems are. I think a big thing we can do, in a sense, is recognize that the NATO war machine doesn't function in isolation. There's a machine behind it, and that machine is the day-to-day activity of this society. And I think as people organize themselves, they can become more and more autonomous of that machine, and as they become more and more autonomous of it, they can begin to attack and dismantle it.
This has been a Steve and Steve production. You have been listening to Society as a Prison on CKDU 88.1 in Halifax.